had a plan. He put the .22 bunt line in his belt in back. On a signal, TJ was to yank out the gun, step out from behind Charlie, and plug the Panther, nail him right there. Only TJ had chickened out, and Manson had to do the shooting himself. Friends of the Black, who were present when the shooting occurred, had later dumped the body in Griffith Park, Danny said. Danny had seen the $2,500 and had been present the next morning when Manson criticized TJ for backing down. DiCarlo described TJ as a really nice guy. His front was trying to be one of Charlie's boys, but he didn't have it inside. TJ had gone along with Manson on everything up to this, but he told him, "I don't want to have nothing to do with snuffing people." A day or two later, he fled in the wind. Question. Who else got murdered up there? What about Shorty? Do you know anything about that? There was a long pause. Then, "That was my ace in the hole." Question. How so? Answer. I was going to save that for the last. Question. Well, might as well clear the thing up now. Has Charlie got something he can smear on you that... Answer. No. No way at all. Nothing. One thing did worry DiCarlo, however. In 1966, he had been convicted of a felony, smuggling marijuana across the Mexican border, a federal charge. He was currently appealing the sentence. He was also under indictment on two other charges. Along with Al Springer and several other straight Satans, he had been charged with selling a stolen motorcycle engine, which was a local charge, and giving false information while purchasing a firearm, using an alias and not disclosing that he had a prior felony conviction, which was federal. Manson was still on parole from a federal pen. So what if they send me to the same place? I don't want to feel a shank in my back and find that little son of a bitch behind me. Question. Let me explain something to you, Danny, so you know where you stand. We're dealing with a guy here who we are pretty sure is responsible for about 13 murders, some of which you don't know about. The figure 13 was just a guess, but DiCarlo surprised them by saying, I know about... I'm pretty sure he did Tate. Question. Okay. We've talked about the Panther. We've talked about Gary Hinman. We're going to talk about Shorty. And you think he did Tate. That's 8. Now, we've got 5 more. All right? Now, our opinion of Charlie is that he's got a little mental problem. But we're in no way going to jeopardize you or anyone else if, for no other reason, we don't want another murder. We're in business to stop murders. And in this business, there's no sense in solving 13 murders if somebody else is going to get killed. That just makes 14. Answer. I'm a nasty motorcycle rider. Question. I don't care what you are personally. Answer. The police's general opinion of me is nothing. Question. That's not my opinion. Answer. I'm not an outstanding citizen. Question. As I told you the other day, Danny, you level with us all the way. Right down the line, no bullshitting. I'm not going to bullshit you, you're not going to bullshit me. We level with each other and I'll go out for you 100%. And I mean it. So that you don't have to go to the joint. Question. Another detective. We've dealt with motorcycle riders before and with all kinds of people. We've gone out on a limb to help them because they've helped us. We'll do our very best to make sure that nobody gets killed. Whether he's a motorcycle rider or the best citizen in the world. Now tell us what you know about Shorty. Early that same evening, November 17, 1969, two LAPD homicide officers, Sergeants Mossman and Brown, appeared at Sybil Brand Institute and asked to see one Ronnie Howard. The interview was brief. They heard enough, however, to realize they were on to something big. Enough, too, to decide it wasn't the best idea to leave Ronnie Howard in the same dormitory with Susan Atkins. Before leaving Sybil Brand, they arranged to have Ronnie move to an isolation unit. Then they drove back to Parker Center, anxious to tell the other detectives that they had cracked the case. Nielsen, Gutierrez, and McGann were still questioning DiCarlo about the murder of Shorty. They already knew something about it, even before talking to Springer and DiCarlo, since Sergeants Whiteley and Gunther had begun their own investigation into the possible homicide after talking to Kitty Lutzinger. They knew Shorty was Donald Jerome Shea, a 36-year-old male Caucasian who had worked at Spawn Ranch on and off for some 15 years as a horse wrangler. Like most of the other cowboys who drifted in and out of Spawn's movie ranch, Shorty was just awaiting the day when some producer discovered he had all the potentials of a new John Wayne or Clint Eastwood. Whenever the prospect of any acting job materialized, Shorty would quit work and go in search of that ever-elusive stardom, which explained why, when in late August he disappeared from Spawn, no one thought too much about it. At first. Kitty had also told LASO that Manson, Clem, Bruce, and possibly Tex had been involved in the killing, and that some of the girls in the family had helped obliterate all traces of the crime. One thing they didn't know, and now asked Danny, was, why did they do it? Answer: because Shorty was going to old man Spawn and snitching, and Charlie didn't like snitches. Question: just about the petty bullshit at the ranch? Answer: that's right. Shorty was telling old man Spawn that he should put him in charge and he would clean everybody up. He would, in short order, run off Manson and his family. Shorty, however, made a fatal mistake. He forgot that little Squeaky was not only George's eyes, she was also Charlie's ears. There were other reasons which Danny enumerated. Shorty had married a black topless dancer. Charlie had a thing about interracial marriages and blacks. Charlie had two enemies, DiCarlo said, the police and the niggers, in that order. Charlie also suspected that Shorty had helped set up the August 16th raid on Spawn. Shorty had been offed about 10 days later. The exact date of Shea's death still remains unknown. It is believed to have occurred on either the night of Monday, August 25th, or Tuesday, August 26th, 1969. And there was the possibility, though this was strictly conjecture on DiCarlo's part, that Shorty had overheard something about some of the other murders. Bruce Davis had told him about Shorty's murder, DiCarlo said. Several of the girls had also mentioned it, as had both Clem and Manson. Danny was unclear as to some of the details, how they had managed to catch Shorty off guard and where, but as for the mode of death, he was more than graphic. Like they were going to do Caesar, they went to the gunroom and picked up a sword and four German bayonets, the latter purchased from an army surplus store for $1 each and honed to razor sharpness. Then, getting Shorty off by himself, they stuck him like carving up a Christmas turkey. Bruce said they cut him up in 9 pieces. They cut his head off. Then they cut his arms off, too, so there was no way they could possibly identify him. They were laughing about that. After killing him, they covered the body with leaves, DiCarlo guessed, but was not sure that this had occurred in one of the canyons behind the ranch buildings. Some of the girls had helped dispose of Shorty's bloody clothing, his automobile, and other possessions. Then Clem came back the next day or that night and buried him good. Question: unidentified voice. Can we break this up for about 15 minutes? Maybe send Danny up to get some coffee? There's been an accident, and they want to talk to you guys. Question: sure. Question: I'm going to send Danny up to the 8th floor. I want him back down here in 15 minutes. Answer: I'll wait right here. Danny was not anxious to be seen wandering the halls of LAPD. Question: it won't take more than 15 minutes. We'll close the door so nobody will know you're in here. There had been no accident. Mossman and Brown had returned from Sybil Brand. As they related what they had heard, the 15 minutes stretched to nearly 45. Although the Atkins-Howard conversations left many unanswered questions, the detectives were now convinced that the Tate and LaBianca cases had been solved. As will become all too apparent, in this instance, solved was a misstatement if ever there was one. Susan Atkins had told Ronnie Howard details. The unpublished words written at the LaBianca residence, the lost knife at Tate, which only one of the killers could know. Lieutenants Helder, Tate, and LePage, LaBianca, were notified. When the detectives returned to the interrogation room, they were in a light-hearted mood. Question? Now, when we left Shorty, he was in 9 pieces, and his head and arms were off. DiCarlo was not told what they had learned, but he must have sensed a change in the questioning. The matter of Shorty was quickly wrapped up. Tate was now the topic. Exactly why did Danny think Manson was involved? Well, there were 2 incidents. Or maybe it was the same incident, Danny was not sure. Anyway, they went out on one caper and they came back with $75. Tex was in on that. And he fucked up his foot, fucking somebody out of it. I don't know whether he put his lights out or not, but he got $75. There were no calendars at Spawn Ranch, DiCarlo had told them earlier. No one paid much attention to what day it was. The one date everyone at the ranch remembered, however, was August 16th, the day of the raid. It was before this. Question. How much before? Answer. Oh, 2 weeks. If DiCarlo's estimate was correct, this would also be before Tate. What was the other incident? Answer. They went out one night. Everybody went but Bruce. Question. Who went? Answer. Charlie, Tex, and Clem. Them 3. Okay, the next morning, one of the detectives interrupted. Had he actually seen them leave? No, only the next morning. Another interruption. Did any of the girls go that night? Answer. No, I am almost positive it was just them 3 that went. Question. Well, do you remember? Were the rest of the girls there that night? Answer. See, the girls were scattered all over the place, and there is no possible way that I could have kept track of who was there and who wasn't there. So it was possible the girls could have gone without DiCarlo's knowing about it. Now, what about the date? This one Danny remembered, more or less, because he was rebuilding the engine on his bike and had to go into town to get a bearing. It was around the 9th, 10th, or 11th of August. And they split that night, and they came back the next morning. Clem was standing in front of the kitchen, DiCarlo said. Danny walked up to him and asked, "What did you do last night?" Clem, according to Danny, smiled that real stupid smile of his. Danny glanced back over his shoulder and saw that Charlie was standing behind him. He got the impression that Clem had been about to answer, but that Charlie had signaled him to be quiet. Clem said something like, "Don't worry about it. We did all right." At this point, Charlie walked off. Before starting after him, Clem put his hand on Danny's arm and said, "We got 5 piggies. There was a great big grin on his face. Clem told DiCarlo, "We got 5 piggies. Manson told Springer, "We knocked off 5 of them just the other night. Atkins confessed to Howard that she stabbed Sharon Tate and Wojtek Frykowski. Beausoleil confessed to DiCarlo that he had stabbed Hinman. Atkins told Howard that she had done the stabbing. Suddenly, the detectives had a surfeit of confessors, so many that they were thoroughly confused as to who was involved in which homicides. Skipping Hinman, which after all was the sheriff's case, and concentrating on Tate, they had 2 versions. One, DiCarlo felt that Charlie, Clem, and Tex, without the help of any of the girls, had killed Sharon Tate and the others. 2, Ronnie Howard understood Susan Atkins to say that she, 2 other girls, the names Linda and Katie had been mentioned, but whether they were involved in this particular homicide was unclear, plus Charles, plus possibly 1 other man, had gone to 10,050 Cielo Drive. As for the LaBianca murders, all they knew was that there were 2 girls and Charlie, that Linda wasn't in on this one, and that Susan Atkins was somehow involved in that collective we. The detectives decided to try another approach. through the other girls at the ranch, but first they wanted to wrap up a few loose ends. What clothing had the three men been wearing? Dark clothing, DiCarlo replied. Charlie had on a black sweater, Levi's, moccasins. Tex was dressed similarly, he thought, though he may have been wearing boots, he wasn't sure. Clem wore Levi's and moccasins, too, plus an olive drab field jacket. Had he noticed any blood on their clothes when he saw them the next morning? No, but then he hadn't been looking for any. Did he have any idea which vehicle they took? Sure, Johnny Swartz's 59 Ford. It was the only car working at that time. Any idea where it was now? It had been hauled off during the August 16th raid, and, so far as Danny knew, was probably still in the impound garage in Canoga Park. Swartz was one of the ranch hands at Spawn, not a family member, but he let them borrow his car. Any idea what Tex's true name was? Charles was his first name, Danny said. He'd seen the last name once on a pink slip, but couldn't recall it. Was it Charles Montgomery, the detectives asked, using a name Kitty Lutzinger had supplied? No, that didn't sound familiar. What about Clem? Does the name Tufts ring any bell? No, he'd never heard Clem called that, but that boy that was found shot up in Topanga Canyon, the 16-year-old kid, wasn't his name Tufts? One of the detectives replied, I don't know. That's the sheriff's case. We got so many murders now. Okay. Now about the girls. How well did you know the broads out there? Answer, pretty well, man. Laughter. The detectives began going through the names the girls had used when arrested in the Spawn and Barker raids, and they immediately encountered problems. Not only had they used aliases when booked, they also used them at the ranch. And not a single alias, but several, seemingly changing names like clothes whenever the mood hit them. As a further complication, they even traded aliases. As if these weren't problems enough, Danny provided another. He was extremely reluctant to admit that any of the girls might be capable of murder. The guys were something else. Bobby, Tex, Bruce, Clem, any would kill, DiCarlo felt, if Charlie told him to. All, it later turned out, had. Ella Jo Bailey was eliminated. She'd left Spawn Ranch before the murders. Mary Brunner and Sandra Good were out also. They'd been in jail both nights. What about Ruth Ann Smack, a.k.a. Ruth Ann Hubelhurst? These were booking names. Her true name was Ruth Ann Morehouse, and she was known in the family as Uish. Danny knew this, but for personal reasons didn't bother to enlighten the detectives. Question. What do you know about her? Answer. She used to be one of my favorite sweeties. Question. Do you think she would have the guts to get into a cold-blooded murder? Danny hesitated a long time before answering. You know, that little girl there is so sweet. What really made me sick to my stomach is when she came up one night, when I was up there in the desert, and she said, I can hardly wait to get my first pig. Little 17-year-old. I looked on her like she was my daughter, just the sweetest little thing you would ever want to meet in your life. She was so beautiful and so sweet. And Charlie fucked her thinking around so much it turned your guts. The date when she told DiCarlo this was determined to be about September 1st. If she hadn't killed by then, she couldn't have been in on LaBianca or Tate. Eliminate Ruth Ann. Ever know a Katie? Yeah, but he didn't know what her real name was. I never knew anyone by their real name, DiCarlo said. Katie was an older broad, not a runaway. She was from down around Venice. His description of her was vague, except that she had so much hair on her body that none of the guys wanted to make it with her. What about Alinda? She was a short broad, Danny said. But she didn't stay long, maybe only a month or so, and he didn't know much about her. She'd left by the time they raided Spawn Ranch. When Sadie went out on creepy crawly missions, did she carry any weapons? One of the detectives asked. Answer, she carried a little knife. They had a bunch of little hunting knives. Buck hunting knives. Question. Buck knives. Answer. Buck knives, right. They now began firing specific questions at DiCarlo. Ever see any credit cards with an Italian name on them? Anybody ever talk about somebody who owned a boat? Ever hear anyone use the name La Bianca? Danny gave no answers to all. What about glasses? Anybody at Spawn wear them? None of them wore glasses because Charlie wouldn't let them wear glasses. Mary Brunner had had several pairs. Charlie had broken them. DiCarlo was shown some two-strand nylon rope. Ever see any rope like this up at Spawn? No, but he had seen some three-strand. Charlie had bought about 200 feet of it at the Jack Frost surplus store in Santa Monica in June or July. Was he sure about that? Sure he was sure. He'd been along when Charlie bought it. Later, he'd coiled it so it wouldn't develop snags. It was the same as they used in the Coast Guard on PT boats. He'd handled it hundreds of times. Although DiCarlo was unaware of it, the Tate Sebring rope was also three-strand. Probably by prearrangement, the detectives began to lean on DiCarlo, adopting a tougher tone. Question. Did you ever caper with any of the guys? Answer. Fuck no. No way at all. Ask any of the girls. Question. Did you have anything to do with Shorty's death? DiCarlo denied it vehemently. Shorty had been his friend. Besides, I've got no balls for putting anybody's lights out. But there was just enough hesitation in his reply to indicate he was hiding something. Pressed, DiCarlo told them about Shorty's guns. Shorty had a matched pair of Colt 45s. He was always hocking, then reclaiming the pistols. In late August or early September, after Shorty had disappeared, but supposedly before DiCarlo knew what had happened to him, Bruce Davis had given him Shorty's pawn tickets on the guns in repayment for some money he owed DiCarlo. Danny had reclaimed the pistols. Later, learning that Shorty had been killed, he'd sold the guns to a Culver City shop for $75. Question. That puts you in a pretty shitty spot. You're aware of that? Danny was. And he got in even deeper when one of the detectives asked him if he knew anything about Lime. When arrested, Mary Brunner was carrying a shopping list made up by Manson. Lime was one of the items listed. Any idea why Charlie would want some lime? Danny recalled that Charlie had once asked him what to use to decompose a body. He had told him lime worked best because he had once used it to get rid of a cat that had died under a house. Question. Why did you tell him that? Answer. No particular reason. He was just asking me. Question. What did he ask you? Answer. Oh, the best way to, to get rid of a body real quick. Question. Did you ever think to say, now what in the fuck makes you ask a question like that, Charlie? Answer. No, because he was nuts. Question. When did that conversation take place? Answer. Right around the time Shorty disappeared. It looked bad, and the detectives left it at that. Although privately they were inclined to accept DiCarlo's tale, suspecting, however, that although he probably had not taken part in the murder, he still knew more than he was telling, it gave them some additional leverage to try and get what they wanted. They wanted two things. Question. Anybody left up at Spawn Ranch that knows you? Answer. Not that I know of. I don't know who's up there. And I don't want to go up there to find out. I don't want nothing to do with the place. Question. I want to look around there, but I need a guide. Danny didn't volunteer. They made the other request straight out. Question. Would you be willing to testify? Answer. No, sir. There were two charges pending against him, they reminded him. On the stolen motorcycle engine, maybe we can get it busted down to a lesser charge. Maybe we can go so far as to get it knocked off. As far as the federal thing is concerned, I don't know how much weight we can push on that. But here again, we can try. Answer. If you try for me, that's fine. That's all I can ask of you. If it came down to being a witness or going to jail, DiCarlo hesitated. Then when he gets out of jail... Question. He isn't going to get out of jail on no first-degree murder beef when you've got over 5 victims involved. If Manson was the guy that was in on the Tate murder, we don't know that for a fact yet. We've got a great deal of information that way. Answer. There's also a reward involved in that. Question. Yes, there is. Quite a bit of a reward. 25 grand. Not to say that one guy is going to get it, but even split, that's a hell of a piece of cash. Answer. I could send my boy through military school with that. Question. Now, what do you think? Would you be willing to testify against this group of people? Answer. He's going to be sitting there looking at me. Manson is, isn't he? Question. If you go to trial and testify, he is. Now, how scared of Manson are you? Answer. I'm scared shitless. I'm petrified of him. He wouldn't hesitate for a second. If it takes him 10 years, he'd find that little boy of mine and carve him to pieces. Question. You give that motherfucker more credit than he deserves. If you think Manson is some kind of a god that is going to break out of jail and come back and murder everybody that testified against him... But it was obvious DiCarlo didn't put that past Manson. Even if he remained in jail, there were the others. Answer. What about Clem? Have you got him locked up? Question. Yeah. Clem is sitting in the cooler up in Independence with Charlie. Answer. What about Tex and Bruce? Question. They're both out. Bruce Davis, the last I heard, sometime earlier this month, was in Venice. Answer. Bruce is down in Venice, huh? I'll have to watch myself. One of my club brothers said he spotted a couple of the girls down in Venice, too. The detectives didn't tell DiCarlo that when Davis was last seen, on November 5th, it was in connection with another death, the suicide of Zero. By this time, LAPD had learned that Zero, a.k.a. Christopher Jesus, true name John Philip Haught, had been arrested in the Barker raid. Earlier, in going through some photographs, DiCarlo had identified Scotty and Zero as 2 young boys from Ohio who had been with the family for a short time but didn't fit in. One of the detectives had remarked, "Zero's no longer with us." Answer. What do you mean he's no longer with us? Question. He's among the dead. Answer. Oh, shit, is he? Question. Yeah, he got a little too high one day, and he was playing Russian roulette. He parked a bullet in his head. While the detectives had apparently bought the story of Zero's death, as related by Bruce Davis and the others, Danny didn't. Not for a minute. No. Danny didn't want to testify. The detectives left it at that. There was still time for him to change his mind. And after all, they now had Ronnie Howard. They let Danny go after making arrangements for him to call in the next day. One of the detectives commented after Danny had left, but while the tape was still on, "I kind of feel like we've done a day's work." The DiCarlo interview had lasted over 7 hours. It was now past midnight on Tuesday, November 18th, 1969. I was already asleep, unaware that in a few hours... As a result of a meeting between the DA and his staff that morning, I would be handed the job of prosecuting the Tate-LaBianca killers. Part 3. The Investigation, Phase 2. No sense makes sense. Charles Manson. November 18th, 1969. By now the listener knows a great deal more about the Tate-LaBianca murders than I did on the day I was assigned that case. In fact, since large portions of the foregoing story have not been made public before this, the reader is an insider, in a sense, highly unusual in a murder case. And in a way, I am a newcomer, an intruder, The sudden switch from an unseen background narrator to a very personal account is bound to be a surprise. The best way to soften it, I suspect, would be to introduce myself. Then, when we've got that out of the way, we'll resume the narrative together. This digression, though unfortunately necessary, will be as brief as possible. A conventional biographical sketch before the Manson trial would probably have read more or less as follows. Vincent T. Bugliosi, age 35, Deputy District Attorney, Los Angeles, California. Born Hibbing, Minnesota. Graduate Hollywood High School. Attended the University of Miami on a tennis scholarship, BA and BBA degrees. Deciding on the practice of law, attended UCLA, LLB degree. President graduating class 1964. Joined the Los Angeles County District Attorney's Office same year. Has tried a number of highly publicized murder cases, Floyd Milton, Perveller Cromwell, etc., obtaining convictions in all. Has tried 104 felony jury trials, losing only one. In addition to his duties as deputy DA, Bugliosi is a professor of criminal law at Beverly School of Law, Los Angeles. Served as technical consultant and edited the scripts of two pilot films for Jack Webb's TV series, The DA. Series star Robert Conrad patterned his part after the young prosecutor. Married, two children. That's probably about how it would read, yet it tells nothing about how I feel toward my profession, which is even more important. The primary duty of a lawyer engaged in public prosecution is not to convict, but to see that justice is done. Those words are from the old canon of ethics of the American Bar Association. I'd thought of them often during the 5 years I'd been a deputy DA. In a very real sense, they had become my personal credo. If in a given case a conviction is justice, so be it. But if it is not, I want no part of it. For far too many years, the stereotyped image of the prosecutor has been either that of a right-wing, law-and-order type intent on winning convictions at any cost, or a stumbling, bumbling Hamilton burger, forever trying innocent people who, fortunately, are saved at the last possible minute by the foxy maneuverings of a Perry Mason. I've never felt the defense attorney has a monopoly on concern for innocence, fairness, and justice. After joining the DA's office, I tried close to 1,000 cases. In a great many, I sought and obtained convictions because I believed the evidence warranted them. In a great many others, in which I felt the evidence was insufficient, I stood up in court and asked for a dismissal of the charges, or requested a reduction in either the charges or the sentence. The latter cases rarely make headlines. Only infrequently does the public learn of them. Thus, the stereotype remains. Far more important, however, is the realization that fairness and justice have prevailed. Just as I never felt the slightest compunction to conform to this stereotype, so did I rebel against another. Traditionally, the role of the prosecutor has been twofold: to handle the legal aspects of the case, and to present in court the evidence gathered by law enforcement agencies. I never accepted these limitations. In past cases, I always joined in the investigation, going out and interviewing witnesses myself, tracking down and developing new leads, often finding evidence otherwise overlooked. In some cases, this led to the release of a suspect, in others to a conviction that otherwise might not have been obtained. For a lawyer to do less than his utmost is, I strongly feel, a betrayal of his client. Though in criminal trials one tends to focus on the defense attorney and his client the accused, the prosecutor is also a lawyer, and he too has a client, the people. And the people are equally entitled to their day in court, to a fair and impartial trial, and to justice. The Tate-LaBianca case was the farthest thing from my mind on the afternoon of November 18th, 1969. I'd just completed a long trial and was on my way back to my office in the Hall of Justice when Aaron Stovitz, head of the Trials Division of the District Attorney's Office and one of the top trial lawyers in an office of 450 deputy district attorneys, grabbed me by the arm and, without a word of explanation, hurried me down the hall into the office of J. Miller Levy, Director of Central Operations. Levy was talking to two LAPD lieutenants I'd worked with on previous cases, Bob Helder and Paul LePage. Listening for a minute, I heard the word Tate. Turning to Aaron, I asked, "Are we going to handle it?" He nodded affirmatively. My only comment was a low whistle. Helder and LePage gave us a sketchy resume of what Ronnie Howard had said. As a follow-up to Mossman and Brown's visit the previous night, two other officers had gone to Sybil Brand that morning and talked to Ronnie for a couple of hours. They had obtained considerably more detail, but there were still huge gaps in the story. To say that the Tate and LaBianca cases had been solved at this point would be a gross overstatement. Obviously, in any murder case, finding the killer is extremely important, but it's only a first step. Neither the finding, the arresting, nor the indicting of a defendant has evidentiary value, and none are proof of guilt. Once the killer is identified, there remains the difficult and sometimes insurmountable problem of connecting him with the crime by strong, admissible evidence, then proving his guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, be it before a judge or a jury. And as yet we hadn't even made the first step, much less the second. In talking to Ronnie Howard, Susan Atkins had implicated herself and Charles, presumably meaning Charles Manson. But Susan had also said that others were involved, and we lacked their actual identities. This was on Tate. On LaBianca, there was virtually no information. One of the first things I wanted to do after reviewing the Howard and DiCarlo statements was to go to Spahn Ranch. Arrangements were made for me to go out the next morning with several of the detectives. I asked Aaron if he wanted to come along, but he couldn't make it. Although Aaron was my superior in the office, we had been assigned the case as co-prosecutors, each of us having an equal say in its handling. Though major, nationally prominent criminal cases of even less magnitude and complexity than the Tate-LaBianca murders frequently have three and sometimes four prosecutors working on the case full-time, for some reason only Aaron and I were assigned to the case. Though neither Aaron nor I could have foreseen that months later he would be yanked off the case, leaving me to go it alone, I did realize from the start that owing to his other duties as head of the trials division, at least his pretrial participation would be limited. When I returned home late that afternoon and told my wife Gail that Aaron and I had been assigned the Tate case, she shared my excitement, but with reservations. She had been hoping that we could take a vacation. It had been months since I'd taken a full day off. Even when I was at home in the evenings, I was either reading transcripts, researching law, or preparing arguments. Although every day I made sure I spent some time with our two children, Vince Jr., 3, and Wendy, 5, when I was on a big case, I totally immersed myself in it. I promised Gail I'd try to take a few days off, but I honestly had to admit that it might be a while before I could do so. At that time, we were, fortunately, unaware that I would be living with the Tate-LaBianca cases for almost 2 years, averaging 100 hours per week, rarely if ever getting to bed before 2 a.m. 7 days per week, and that the few moments Gail, the kids, and I had together would be devoid of privacy, our home transformed into a fortress, a bodyguard not only living with us but accompanying me everywhere I went, following a threat by Charles Manson that he would kill Bugliosi. November 19th to 21st, 1969. We'd picked a hell of a day for a search. The wind was incredible. By the time we reached Chatsworth, it was almost buffeting us off the road. It wasn't a long drive, well under an hour. From the Hall of Justice in downtown Los Angeles, it's about 30 miles to Chatsworth. Going north on Topanga Canyon Boulevard past Devonshire for about 2 miles, we made a sharp left onto Santa Susana Pass Road. Once heavily traveled, but in recent years bypassed for a faster freeway, the two-lane road winds upward a mile or two. Then suddenly, around a bend and to the left, there it was, Spahn's Movie Ranch. Its ramshackle main street was less than 20 yards from the highway, in plain view. Wrecked automobile and truck bodies littered the area. There wasn't a sign of life. There was an unreality to the place, accentuated by the roaring wind and the appearance of total desertion, but even more so by the knowledge, if the Atkins-Howard story was true, of what had begun and ended here. A run-down movie set off in the middle of nowhere, from which dark-clad assassins would venture out at night to terrorize and kill, then return before dawn to vanish into the surroundings. It might have been the plot of a horror film, except that Sharon Tate and at least 8 other real human beings were now dead. We pulled off onto the dirt road, stopping in front of the Long Branch Saloon. In addition to myself, there were Lieutenant Helder and Sergeant Calkins of the Tate team, Sergeant Lee of SID, Sergeants Gunther, Whiteley, and William Gleason from LASO, and our guide, Danny DiCarlo. Danny had finally agreed to accompany us, but only on one condition, that we handcuff him. That way, if any members of the family were still around, they wouldn't think he was voluntarily flapping to the fuzz. Though the sheriff's deputies had been to the ranch before, we needed DiCarlo for a specific purpose, to point out the areas where Manson and the family target practiced. The object of our search? Any .22-caliber bullets and or shell casings. But first I wanted to obtain George Spahn's permission to search the ranch. Gunther pointed out his shack, which was to the right and apart from the western set. We knocked, and a voice, that of a young girl, said, "Come right on in." It was as if every fly in the area had taken shelter there during the storm. 81-year-old George Spahn was sitting in a decaying armchair, wearing a Stetson and dark glasses. In his lap was a chihuahua, at his feet a cocker spaniel. A hippie girl of about 18 was fixing his lunch, while a transistor radio tuned to a cowboy station blared "Young Love" by Sonny James. It seemed as staged as the setting itself. According to DiCarlo, Manson called his girls "Young Loves." Because of Spahn's near blindness, Calkins handed him his badge to feel. Once we had identified ourselves, Spahn seemed to relax. Asked for permission to search, he magnanimously replied, "It's my ranch, and you're welcome to search it any time you want to, day or night, and as often as you like." I explained his legal rights. Under the law, no search warrant was required, only his permission. If he did give permission, however, it might be necessary at some later date for him to testify to this in court. Spahn still agreed. There was no mention of Manson and his family, but Spahn must have known that they were in some way the reason for our being there. Although on other occasions I would interview George at length, our conversation at this time was brief and confined to the search. Once we went back outside, people began appearing from almost every building. There must have been 10 to 15, most of them young, most in hippie-type clothes, although a few appeared to be ranch hands. How many, if any, were actual members of the family, we didn't know. While looking around, I heard some odd sounds coming from a doghouse. Leaning down and looking in, I saw 2 dogs and, crouched in the corner, a toothless, white-haired old woman of about 80. I later checked with one of the ranch hands to see if she needed help, but he said she was happy where she was. It was a very strange place. About 100 yards behind the main cluster of buildings, there was a drop down to a creek. Then beyond it, the hills rose up and became a part of the Santa Susana mountain range. Rocky, brush-covered, the area looked far more rugged than it actually was. I wondered how many times as a boy I'd seen this scene in B-grade cowboy films. According to Lutzinger and DiCarlo, it was here, in the canyons and gullies behind the ranch, and across the road in Devil's Canyon, that the family hid out from the police. Here, too, somewhere in this area, if the various accounts were correct, were the remains of Donald Shorty Shea. Charlie's favorite firing spot, DiCarlo said, was in the creek bed, well out of sight from the road. As targets, he used fence posts and a trash can. Under the direction of Sergeant Lee, we began searching. Though no shell casings had been found at 10,050 Cielo Drive, the bunt line being a revolver which doesn't automatically eject its shell casings, we wanted to collect both in case the gun or additional evidence was found. While we were searching the creek bed, I kept thinking about George Spahn, alone and almost defenseless in his blindness. I asked, "Anybody bring a tape recorder?" Calkins had. It was in the back of his car. "Let's go back and get Spahn's consent on tape," I said. "Between now and the time we go to trial, I don't want some SOB putting a knife to Spahn's throat, forcing him to say he didn't give us permission." We went back and taped Spahn's consent. It was for his protection as well as our own. Knowing the tape existed could be discouragement. DiCarlo indicated another area about a quarter of a mile up one of the canyons, where Charlie and the men sometimes target practiced. We found a number of bullets and shell casings there. Because of the wind and dust, the search was less thorough than I'd hoped for. However, Sergeant Lee promised to return at a later date and see what he could find. Altogether, that day we found approximately 68 22 caliber bullets. Approximate because some were fragments rather than whole slugs, and 22 shell casings of the same caliber. Lee put them in envelopes, noting where and when found, and took them back to the police lab with him. While looking around the corral area, I spotted some white nylon rope, but it was 2 strand, not 3. Gunther and Whiteley had made their own find in Danny DiCarlo. That afternoon they interviewed him on the Hinman murder and Beausoleil's confession. The only problem was that the Beausoleil trial had been going on for a week now, and both the prosecution and defense had rested. Against the objections of Beausoleil's attorney, a continuance was obtained until the following Monday, at which time the prosecution hoped to reopen its case to introduce the confession. It was agreed that if DiCarlo testified in the Beausoleil trial, LASO would drop the motorcycle engine theft charge against him. On my return to the Hall of Justice, there was a meeting in the office of the then Assistant District Attorney, Joseph Bush. Present, in addition to Bush, Stovitz, and myself from the DA's office, were Lieutenant Paul LePage, LaBianca, and Sergeant Mike McGann, Tate, representing LAPD. The police wanted to wrap up the case, Lieutenant LePage informed us. The public pressure on LAPD to solve these murders was unbelievable. Every time Chief Edward M. Davis encountered a reporter, he was asked, "What, if anything, is happening on Tate?" LAPD wanted to offer Susan Atkins immunity in exchange for telling what she knew about the murders. I was in total disagreement. If what she told Ronnie Howard is true, Atkins personally stabbed to death Sharon Tate, Gary Hinman, and who knows how many others. We don't give that gal anything. Chief Davis wanted to rush the case to the grand jury, LePage said. But before that, he wanted to break the news that we had caught the killers in a big press conference. "We don't even have a case to take to the grand jury," I told LePage. "We're not even sure who the killers are, or if they're free or in custody. All we have is a good lead, but we're getting there. Let's see if, on our own, we can get enough evidence to nail all of them. If we can't, then, as a last resort, a very, very last resort, we can turn to Atkins." I could sympathize with LAPD. The media were blasting the department almost daily. On the other hand, it would be nothing compared to the public response if we let Susan Atkins walk off scot-free. I couldn't forget Susan describing how it felt to taste Sharon Tate's blood. Wow, what a trip. LePage was firm. LAPD wanted to make a deal. I conferred with Bush and Stovitz. They were far less adamant than I. Against my very strong objections, Bush told LePage that the DA's office would be willing to settle for a second-degree murder plea for Atkins. Susan Atkins would be offered a deal. The precise terms, or whether she would even accept them, remained unknown. At 8 that night, the citizens of Los Angeles, still thinking that the Tate-LaBianca killers were completely unknown, 2 cars sped out of Los Angeles, their destination the last home of the Manson family, Death Valley. It seemed more than ironic that following the murders, Manson had chosen as his refuge a place so aptly named. Sergeants Nielsen, Sartucci, and Granado were in 1 car, Sergeants McGann, Gene Camadoy, and I were in the other. We broke a few speed limits along the way, arriving in Independence, California, at 1:30 a.m. Independence, seat of Inyo County, is not a large town. The county itself, though second largest in the state, has less than 16,000 residents, just over one per square mile. If one were looking for a hideaway, he could find few better. We checked into the Winnedumah Hotel for what amounted to little more than a long nap. When I got up at 5:30, the temperature had dropped below zero. I slipped my clothes on over my pajamas and was still cold. Before leaving Los Angeles, I had telephoned Frank Foles, Inyo County DA, and we had arranged to meet at a nearby cafe at 6 a.m. Foles, his deputy Buck Gibbons, and their investigator Jack Gardner were already there. The three men were, I would soon learn, very conscientious. The help they would give us in the months ahead would be considerable. At the moment, they were also very excited. Unexpectedly, they were in the middle of one of the most publicized murder cases in modern history, the Tate case. Then, with puzzled looks, they'd glance across the table at the big city prosecutor, pajamas sticking out of his cuffs. Foles told me that although they had seized some of Manson's belongings during the October raid on Barker Ranch, a number of things remained there, including an old school bus, which was littered with clothing and other items. I suggested that before leaving Independence, we obtain a search warrant for the ranch that specifically mentioned the bus. This caught Foles by surprise. I explained that if we did find evidence and wished to use it in a trial, we didn't want it suppressed just because someone suddenly appeared with a pink slip saying, "I'm the real owner of the bus. I only loaned it to Charlie and you didn't get my permission." Foles understood that. It was only, he explained cryptically, that they didn't do things quite that way in Inyo County. We returned to his office and, after waiting for the typist to come to work, I dictated the warrant. It was necessary to state exactly what we were looking for. Among the items I enumerated were a .22 caliber revolver, knives and other weapons, rope, wire cutters, wallet, driver's license, and credit cards belonging to Rosemary LaBianca, motor plates to any vehicle, any male and or female clothing, including footwear. It was also necessary that I cite the crime, 187 PC, murder, and the suspected perpetrators, tentatively believed to be Charles Manson, Clem Tufts, Charles Montgomery, Sadie Glutz, and one or more additional females. The information was based on the testimony of two untested informants, whom I did not name, but who were Ronnie Howard and Danny DiCarlo. When typed, the warrant ran to 16 pages. It was an impressive document, the evidence cited therein more than sufficient to obtain a search warrant. Only I was aware how weak our case actually was. With McGann and me tagging along, Foles took the warrant to the office of Judge John P. McMurray. The white-haired jurist was, I guessed, in his 70s. He told us he was near retirement. A search warrant? Judge McMurray looked at it with amusement. This was the first one he had seen in 18 years, he told us. In Inyo, he explained, men are men. If you knock on a door and the people inside don't want to let you in, you assume they are hiding something and bust the door in. A search warrant indeed. But he read and signed it. In 1971, California Governor Ronald Reagan arranged to have Judge McMurray taken out of retirement to try the Angela Davis case. The defense challenged him for cause. The trip to Barker Ranch would take 3 hours, leaving us little more than an hour to search before the sun set. En route, Foles told me some of the things he had learned about the Manson family. Exact dates, details, quotes from the investigating officers, etc., I would obtain the following day when going over reports of the various law enforcement agencies. When booked, almost all the family members used aliases. In a number of cases, their true names were not known until much later. The first few members, in effect a scouting party, had appeared in the area in the fall of 1968. Since you have to be somewhat different to want to live on the edge of Death Valley, residents of the area had developed a tolerance for people who elsewhere would have been considered odd types. The hippies were no stranger than others who passed through. Prospectors, desert rats, chasers after legendary lost mines. There were only a few minor brushes with the authorities. The girls were advised to desist from panhandling in Shoshone, and one made the mistake of giving a marijuana cigarette to a 15-year-old girl, who just happened to be the sheriff's niece. Until September 9, 1969, when National Park Rangers discovered that someone had attempted to burn a Michigan loader, a piece of earth-moving equipment that was parked in the racetrack area of Death Valley National Monument. It appeared a senseless act of vandalism. Automobile tracks leading away from the area were determined to belong to a Toyota. Several persons recalled seeing the hippies driving a red Toyota and a dune buggy. On September 21st, Park Ranger Dick Powell spotted a 1969 red Toyota in the Hale and Hall area. The four females and one male who were riding in it were questioned but not detained. Powell later ran a license check, learning that the plates on the Toyota belonged to another vehicle. On September 24th, Powell returned to look for the group, but they had gone. On September 29th, Powell, accompanied by California Highway Patrolman James Purcell, decided to check out Barker Ranch. They found two young girls there, but no vehicles. As they had found standard in their contacts with this group, the girls gave vague, uncommunicative answers to their questions. As the officers were leaving the area, they encountered a truck driven by Paul Crockett, 46, a local miner. With him was Brooks Poston, 18, who had previously been a member of the hippie band, but was now working for Crockett. On hearing that there were two girls at the ranch, Crockett and Poston appeared apprehensive, and when questioned, finally admitted that they feared for their lives. Powell and Purcell decided to accompany them back to Barker. The two girls had vanished, but the officers presumed they were still nearby, probably watching them. They began questioning Crockett and Poston. The officers had come looking for arson suspects and a possible stolen vehicle. They found something totally unexpected. From Purcell's report, the interview resulted in some of the most unbelievable and fantastic information we had ever heard. Tales of drug use, sex orgies, the actual attempt to recreate the days of Rommel and the Desert Corps by tearing over the countryside by night in numerous dune buggies, the stringing of field phones around the area for rapid communication, the opinion of the leader that he is Jesus Christ and seemed to be trying to form a cult of some sort. The surprises weren't over. Before leaving Barker, Powell and Purcell decided to check out some draws back of the ranch. To quote Powell, "In doing so, we stumbled into a group of seven females, all nude or partially so, hiding behind various clumps of sagebrush. They saw one male, but he ran away when they approached. They questioned the girls, but received no useful information. In searching the area, the officers found the red Toyota and a dune buggy, carefully camouflaged with tarps." The officers had a problem. Because of the Panamint mountain range, they couldn't use their police radio. They decided to leave and return later with more men. Before departing, they removed several parts from the engine of the Toyota, rendering it inoperative. The dune buggy had no engine, so they weren't concerned with it. They would later learn that as soon as we left, the suspects pulled the complete Volkswagen engine from under a pile of brush, put it in the disabled dune buggy, and drove off within 2 hours. A check on the two vehicles revealed wants on both. The Toyota had been rented from a Hertz agency in Encino, a town near Los Angeles, on a credit card stolen in a residential burglary. The dune buggy had been stolen off a used car lot only 3 days before Powell and Purcell saw it. On the night of October 9th, officers from the California Highway Patrol, the Inyo County Sheriff's Office, and National Park Rangers assembled near Barker for a massive raid on the ranch to commence the following morning. At about 4 a.m., as several of the officers were proceeding down one of the draws some distance from the ranch, they spotted two males asleep on the ground. Between them was a sawed-off shotgun. The two, Clem Tufts, true name Steve Grogan, and Randy Morgley, true name Hugh Rocky Todd, were placed under arrest. Though the officers were unaware of it, the pair had been stalking human game. Stephanie Schramm and Kitty Lutzinger, two 17-year-old girls who had fled the ranch the previous day. Another male, Robert Ivan Lane, a.k.a. Soupspoon, was apprehended on a hill overlooking the ranch. Lane had been acting as lookout but had fallen asleep. There was still another lookout post, this one a very well-disguised dugout, its tin roof hidden by brush and dirt on a hill south of the ranch. The officers had almost passed it when they saw a female emerge from the brush, squat and urinate, then disappear back into the bushes. While two officers covered the entrance with their rifles, one climbed above the dugout and dropped a large rock on the tin roof. The occupants rushed out. Apprehended were Luella Maxwell Alexandria, true name Leslie Van Houten, a.k.a. Leslie Sangston, Marnie K. Reeves, true name Patricia Krenwinkle, and Manon Manette, true name Catherine Scher, a.k.a. Gypsy. Those inside the ranch house were caught unawares and offered no resistance. They were Donna K. Powell, true name Susan Denise Atkins, a.k.a. Sadie Mae Glutz, Elizabeth Elaine Williamson, true name Lynette Frome, a.k.a. Squeaky, and Linda Baldwin, true name Madeline Cottage, a.k.a. Little Patty. Other members of the raiding party surrounded nearby Myers Ranch, where the group had also been staying, arresting Sandra Collins Pugh. This was her married name. Her maiden name was Sandra Good, a.k.a. Sandy. Rachel Susan Morse, true name Ruth Ann Morehouse, a.k.a. Uish. Marianne Schwarm, true name Diane Von Ahn. And Sidette Perel, true name Nancy Pittman, a.k.a. Brenda McCann. A total of 10 females and 3 males were arrested during this first sweep of the Barker Ranch area. They ranged in age from 16 to 26, with the average 19 or 20. 2 babies were also found. Zizozos Zadfrak Glutz, age 1 year, whose mother was Susan Atkins, and Sunstone Hawk, age 1 month, whose mother was Sandra Good. Both were badly sunburned. Mrs. Powell, wife of Ranger Dick Powell, who had been brought along as matron, took care of them. A search of the area revealed a number of hidden vehicles, mostly dune buggies, mostly stolen. A mail bag with a .22 Ruger single-shot pistol inside, also stolen. A number of knives, and caches of food, gasoline, and other supplies. Also found were more sleeping bags than people, indicating that there might be others still in the area. The officers decided to take the prisoners into Independence and book them, then make a surprise raid at a later date in case the others returned. The strategy paid off. The second raid occurred on October 12th, 2 days after the first. CHP Officer Purcell and 2 park rangers arrived in the area before their support and were hiding in the brush, waiting for the others, when they saw 4 males walk from one of the washes to the ranch house and enter. Purcell spotted Sheriff's Deputy Don Ward of the backup unit approaching in the distance. It was already after 6 p.m., the dusk rapidly becoming dark. Not wanting to risk a gunfight at night, Purcell decided to act. While Powell covered the front of the building, Purcell drew his gun, and to quote from his report, "I quickly moved to the back door, flung it open, and making as much use of the wall on the left of the doorway as possible, I ordered all occupants to remain still and place their hands on their heads." The group, most of whom had been sitting around the kitchen table, were ordered outside, lined up, and searched. There were 3 females, Diane Bluestein, true name Diane Lake, a.k.a. Snake, Beth Tracy, true name Collie Sinclair, and Sherry Andrews, true name Claudia Lee Smith. Plus 4 males, Bruce McGregor Davis, a.k.a. Bruce McMillan, Christopher Jesus, true name John Philip Haught, a.k.a. Zero, who in less than a month would be shot to death while allegedly playing Russian roulette, Kenneth Richard Brown, a.k.a. Scott Bell Davis, Zero's partner from Ohio, and 1 Lawrence Bailey, a.k.a. Larry Jones. There was no sign of the group's leader, Charles Manson. Purcell decided to recheck the house. It was completely dark now. However, a homemade candle was burning in a glass mug on the table, and taking that, he began searching the rooms. On entering the bathroom, I was forced to move the candle around quite a bit as it made a very poor light. I lowered the candle toward the hand basin and small cupboard below and saw long hair hanging out of the top of the cupboard, which was partially open. It seemed impossible that a person could get into such a small space, but without Purcell's having to say anything, a figure began to emerge from the tiny cupboard. After I recovered from the initial shock, I advised the subject to continue out and not make any false moves. As he emerged, he made a comment, more or less in a humorous vein, about being glad to get out of that cramped space. The subject was dressed entirely in buckskins, much differently than all the others we had found. I asked the subject who he was. He immediately replied, "Charlie Manson." He was taken to the back door and turned over to the officers outside. On re-entering the house, Purcell found still another male who was just emerging from the bedroom. He was David Lee Hammack, a.k.a. Bill Vance, an ex-con with more aliases than Manson. Purcell noted the time, 6:40 p.m. None of the suspects were armed, although several sheath knives were found on the kitchen table. The prisoners were handcuffed and, hands on heads, walked single file towards Sourdough Springs, where the officers had left two pickups. En route, they encountered two more females driving a car loaded with groceries. Also placed under arrest were Patty Sue Jardin, true name Catherine Gillies, and Sue Bartell, a.k.a. Country Sue. All the suspects were loaded in the back of one pickup, the second following immediately behind to provide illumination. As they neared the Lotus Mine area, about 3 miles from Barker, Manson told the officers that he had left his pack there, near the side of the road. Purcell, he asked us to stop and pick it up, which we agreed to do. However, we could not locate it by his directions, and we refused to let him loose to search himself as he requested. On the way to Independence, Manson told Purcell and Ward that the blacks were going to take over the country and that he and his group only wanted to find a quiet, peaceful place away from the conflict. But the establishment, as represented by the police, wouldn't let them alone. He also told them that they, being both cops and white, were in deep trouble and should escape to the desert or somewhere while they still had the chance. Also during the ride, again according to Purcell, two things happened which indicated to me the leadership exerted over the group by Subject Manson. At least twice Charlie made statements that would cause the others to say amen 2 or 3 times in unison. Also a few times when the others would become involved in whispered, giggly conversations, Charlie would simply look at them, and immediately they would fall silent. The amazing part of the stare, Purcell noted, was how obvious the results were, without a word being spoken. On arriving in Independence, the suspects were charged with grand theft auto, arson, and various other offenses. The leader of the family was fingerprinted, photographed, and booked as Manson Charles M., a.k.a. Jesus Christ, God. According to Frank Foles, although all but 3 of the 11 vehicles recovered were stolen, there was insufficient evidence to link most of the group with the thefts, and after a few days more than half of those arrested were released. Though most had left the area, 2 of the girls, Squeaky and Sandy, had rented a motel room and were staying in Independence so they could run errands for Manson and the others still in custody. I asked Foles if he knew why the group had come to the area in the first place. He told me that one of the girls, Kathy Gillies, was the granddaughter of the woman who owned Myers Ranch. The family had apparently camped there first, then moved to nearby Barker. After the raid, a sheriff's deputy interviewed Mrs. Arlene Barker, who was living at Indian Ranch in the Panamint Valley. She told him that about a year ago Manson had visited her, asking permission to camp at Barker Ranch. Like George Spahn, Mrs. Barker presumed there were only a few people and that they intended to stay only a few days. On this visit, Manson gave her a gold record, which had been presented to the Beach Boys, commemorating $1 million in sales of their LP, The Beach Boys Today. Manson told her that he was the composer or arranger for the group. Manson had contacted her again 2 or 3 weeks before the October raid, wanting to buy Barker Ranch. She told him she wanted cash. Manson said he'd see her again when he had it. Apparently, Manson felt that if he actually owned the property, he would have fewer problems with local law enforcement agencies. I was unaware until much later that Manson supposedly had an alternate plan to get control of Myers Ranch, which called for murdering Kathy's grandmother. I had no evidence that Kathy Gillies was a party to this plot, and that the plan had been frustrated by something very simple and commonplace. While en route to her home, the three killers he'd chosen had a flat tire. I asked Foles about the evidence recovered in the raids and subsequent searches. Were any of the knives Buck brand? Yes, several. Any rope? No. What about wire cutters? Yes, there was a big red pair. They'd found them in the back of what they later learned was Manson's personal, or command, dune buggy. Aside from the Ruger 22 and Clem's shotgun, any other firearms? Not one, Foles said. In none of the searches did the officers turn up the machine guns, shotguns, rifles, pistols, and large stores of ammunition Crockett, Poston, and others said the family had. Throughout the trials that followed, we would remain very aware that those members of the family still at large probably had access to a sizable cache of arms and ammunition. Barker Ranch was located in Golar Wash, one of 7 dry washes in the Panamint Range, approximately 22 miles southeast of Ballarat. He had been all over the country, Foles told me. Those dry washes comprised the roughest terrain he had ever seen. We'd have to walk much of it, he said, otherwise our heads would bounce through the roof of the 4-wheel drive Jeep Foles had chosen for the trip. Ah, come on, Frank, I said. It can't be that rough. It was. The washes were extremely narrow and rock-strewn. Going up them, we'd frequently gain 1 foot, then with an angry screech of rubber, slide back 2. You could smell the tires burning. Finally, Foles and I got out of the vehicle and walked in front of it, removing boulders as McGann drove forward, foot after foot. It took us 2 hours to travel 5 miles. I asked Foles to have photographs taken of the washes. I wanted to show the jury how isolated and remote an area the killers had chosen for their hiding place. Circumstantial evidence, a tiny speck, but of such specks, one after another, are strong cases made. No one would have chosen to live at either Barker or Myers Ranch, which were about 1/4 mile apart, except for one thing. There was water. There was even a swimming pool at Barker, though, like the stone ranch house and outlying shacks, it was in disrepair. The house was small. Living room, bedroom, kitchen, bathroom. I also wanted photos of the cabinet under the sink where Manson hid. It measured 3 by 1.5 by 1.5 feet. I could see why Purcell was so surprised. When I saw the large school bus, I couldn't believe Manson had brought it up out of the washes. He hadn't, Foles told me. He'd driven it in over the road on the Las Vegas side. Even that had been an ordeal, and the condition of the bus showed it. It was a battered green and white. On the side was an American flag decal with the slogan, America, love it or leave it. While Sartucci and the others searched the house, I went to work on the abandoned bus. The placement of the warrant took some thought. It had to be left in sight. However, if it was, anyone could come along and remove it. I didn't want a defense attorney contending we hadn't fulfilled the requirements of the search. I put it on one of the racks just under the roof of the bus. You could see it, if you looked up. At least 1 foot of clothing was piled on the floor. I later learned that wherever the family stayed, they kept a community clothing pile. When an item was needed, they'd root through the pile until they found it. I got down on my hands and knees and began rooting too. I was looking for 2 things in particular, clothing with bloodstains and boots. A bloody boot heel print had been found on the front porch of the Tate residence. There was a small mark, a little indentation in the heel that I was hoping we could match up. Although I found several boots, none had such a mark. and when Joe Granado applied the benzidine test to the clothing, the results were uniformly negative. I had all the clothing taken back to L.A. anyway, hoping SID might come up with something in the lab. There were 8 to 10 magazines in the bus, half of which were National Geographics. Looking through them, I noticed something curious, all dated from 1939 to 1945, and all had articles on Hitler. One also had photographs of Rommel and his Desert Corps. But that was about all we found. Our search appeared to have yielded little, if anything, of evidentiary value. However, I was anxious to go through the items picked up in the raids. On the way back to Independence, we stopped in Lone Pine. While I was nursing a beer with the officers, Sartucci remarked that he and Patchett had interviewed Manson in Independence some weeks earlier, questioning him about the Tate as well as the LaBianca murders. The following day, when I called Lieutenant Helder, I mentioned this, thinking he probably had a report on the interview. Helder was amazed. He had no idea anyone from LAPD had ever talked to Manson. This was my first indication that the Tate and LaBianca detectives hadn't exactly been working hand in glove. Helder did have some news. It wasn't good. Sergeant Lee had run a ballistics comparison on the .22-caliber bullets we'd found at Spawn. All were negative to those recovered at 10,050 Cielo Drive. I wasn't about to give up that easily. I still wanted a much more thorough search of Spawn Ranch. We stayed at the Winnedooma again that night. Up early the next morning, I walked to the courthouse. I'd forgotten what fresh air smelled like, that trees, grass, have scents. In L.A. there are no smells, just smog. A couple of blocks from the courthouse I saw two young girls, one carrying a baby. It was a wild guess, but I asked, "Are you Sandy and Squeaky?" They admitted they were. I identified myself and said that I would like to talk to them in the district attorney's office at 1 p.m. They said they would come if I would buy them some candy. I said I would. In the DA's office, Foles opened his files and gave me everything he had on the Manson family. Sartucci set to work photocopying. In going through the documents, I spotted a reference to Crockett and Poston. Inyo County Deputy Sheriff Don Ward talked to the two miners in Shoshone and has their entire conversation recorded. I wanted to interview the pair, but it would save time if I heard the tape first, so I asked McGann to contact Ward and get it for me. There was also an October 2, 1969 California Highway Patrol report in which it was stated, "Deputy Dennis Cox has FIR card on suspect Charles Montgomery, 23 years of age, date of birth 12/2/45. Field interrogation reports are 3x5 cards that are made whenever a person is stopped and questioned. I wanted to see that card. We still knew very little about Tex, who hadn't been arrested in either the Spawn or Barker raids. After going through the large stack of documents, I started on the evidence seized in the October 10-12 raid. I had Granado test the knives for blood. Negative. The wire cutters were large and heavy. It would have been difficult to shinny up a telephone pole with them. Still, maybe they were the only pair available. I gave them to the officers so SID could make comparison cuts on the Tate telephone wires. Boots, but no discernible heel mark. I put them aside for SID. I checked the labels on all the clothing, noting that a number of the women's garments, though now filthy, came from expensive shops. I had them taken to L.A. for analysis. I also wanted Winifred Chapman and Suzanne Struthers to look at them, to see if any of the items might have been the property of Sharon Tate, Abigail Folger, or Rosemary LaBianca. Squeaky and Sandy kept the appointment. I'd done a little checking before talking to them. Though the information was sketchy, I knew that both had been born in Southern California and had come from fairly well-to-do families. Squeaky's parents lived in Santa Monica. Her father was an aeronautical engineer. Sandy's parents had divorced and remarried. Her father was